Yeah, sure. I've got an MC. How do the MCs hold on like this?
Something like that, yeah.
I wish I could do that. I can't do that. I need to learn to beatbox.
Hello, I'm sitting here with Dr. Kate Stone. Who are you, Kate?
Who am I? Oh, that's a deep question. I can't just answer, can I? My name's Kate Stone. I call myself a creative scientist. And I run a technology company which is based in the UK, where we develop technology to make everyday things interactive using printing processes.
One thing that you mentioned today was something that has dwelled in my mind for some time. I don't like technology being between people, a screen, stuff like that. Usually when you have a conversation, sometimes you might get a message. Yeah, you fetch your phone and you do some stuff.
Sorry, what were you saying?
Yeah, exactly, like that.
I was just sending a text. I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Pretty much that.
I was doing my Facebook.
Yeah.
And doing my Instagram.
And when you had your talk late this evening, mm-hmm. you mentioned that you think that technology might disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, sure. So I think I've drank that beer, and I'm worried that I might accidentally burp while we're doing this podcast.
Yeah, that's great.
I think that technology is like a veneer that stands between us and a natural experience, and that veneer is getting thinner and thinner and thinner until eventually there'll be no perceived. There'll be no perceived veneer.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think about when I've looked at, or just thinking about the journey of a computer, is the thing that I spoke about, was just to say, computer used to fill a room.
Yeah.
Then it used to fill our desk. Then it filled our lap.
Yeah.
Now it fills the palm of our hand. So it's not that we want to, or we're going to make technology disappear. It's an inevitability.
Yeah.
Just like the tide going out.
Mm.
It's going to happen, because that's the journey that technology and computers are on. And as computers disappear, and as that veneer gets thinner, it gets proportionally more powerful. So it can do more, and it's less invasive.
Yeah.
So one day, not too far away from now, we will wake up and all the technology will be gone. It will have disappeared into all of the everyday things around us. And we will use our voice to talk to an object, a gesture to kind of give a command that something should do something for you. Or we will touch it, and then something magical will happen. And all of the things that we sort of magical stories we've heard, fairy tales we've heard, you know, like the Mary Poppins, or I mean, not that's a fairy tale, but we just, you know, the way we think about things is always magical.
Yeah.
And so I believe that that is the future, and that the future will look more like the past than the present.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a nice picture that you're painting. And I don't know if I'm misquoting. I am actually not able to quote, because I can't remember his name. That's how you would perceive an alien, perhaps, that it's magical or it's godlike, if the difference between your conceptual thinking and what you see is too far.
Exactly, because when we don't know, we don't know how something works, we don't know how it happens, we assume that it's magic.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so what we are doing is we are going to create literally magical experiences, and we will have magical powers, because like you say, if someone looked at an alien, they will think they have magical powers. If we were to look at ourselves from 30 years ago to now, we would think we had magical powers. We would also think we're totally insane.
Yeah,
when everyone's walking down the street talking to themselves, or holding their arms out in front of them, walking around as if they're zombies. Like, just from 20, 30 years ago, we'd be totally shocked if we saw ourselves, even though we imagined a futuristic world.
Yeah.
I mean, if from 30 years ago you imagined the future, it was going to look futuristic. It doesn't. It looks like it used to.
There's no silver clothes stuff. No.
No, because but we have to do that when we create films or shows or photographs or images. We have to make it look futuristic.
Yeah.
Just so that we can see that it's futuristic. Yeah. But the reality is it will look very, very old-fashioned. Yeah.
Well, I certainly subscribe to that idea. Mm-hmm. However, when we talk on this podcast, on this show, we try to see that the norm might shift, the paradigm, something like that, right, in English, paradigm, mm-hmm. might shift as well. So what you're saying is rather a way of reappreciating natural life, and that might certainly happen, but it might not as well. It might be more industrialized and stuff, depending on where our norms shift, and then we get even more less interpersonal than we are today, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In that world, your vision wouldn't fit. Then we would have something that is really, really technical. And do you get where I'm mm-hmm. heading? Do you see, or are you 100% that we will be more the magic world?
And I think, I mean, the way the universe works mm-hmm. is the paradigm of the universe is a pendulum.
Yeah.
The paradigm shift of the universe is a pendulum.
Yeah.
Things always swing back.
Yeah.
Backwards and forwards. That's how the universe works.
Yeah.
There's no escape. That's how the universe works. We are of the universe. Everything we do, everything we think and feel is from that.
Yeah.
And the whole universe is based upon things swinging from one place to the next.
Yeah.
Always swinging back.
Cool. Just wanted to see if I could make something of the norm question there. One thing more that I reacted to is could you explain the difference between being a maker and being a creator?
Yeah. Okay. So, okay.
I think I know, but it's nice to
it's
hear
it's kind of controversial.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I feel like it's controversial because there's a whole like maker movement, and I just feel okay. I decided to pretend that I'm anti-maker.
Yeah.
So I'm against the maker world.
Yeah.
I'm not really, but you know, I just want to help people think.
Yeah.
So, okay, makers do things like 3D print their name.
Yeah.
Solder two wires to make a red light turn green, and write an app that says "Hello World."
Yeah.
And they are so impressed with their technical achievement, but I don't care.
Yeah.
And no one really cares. Because if you're just a maker, then you're generally impressed and satisfied with your technical prowess that you've achieved. And it's about achieving those skills and doing something that's outside your skill set.
Yeah.
However, inside every maker is a creator.
Yeah.
And being a creator is creating experiences that make people laugh, make people cry, so triggers emotions, help inform people, help take people on a journey, doing creative things, and just so happening to use the skills of a maker.
Mm.
And while we have things like, you know, make spaces and open source and all of that that makes things accessible, it's still kind of like only accessible if you're privileged to have that skill set.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that way.
No.
Anyone should be able to access that skill set, just like they can use a pencil and paper. Might not be very good at drawing with it. Like, I can't draw or, you know, anything, but I can use a pencil and paper. There's not a technical barrier there for me. And so I think we need to make these skills available so that anyone can use them.
Yeah.
So that they're easier than using, you know, a social media tool. But remembering that it's all about the creativity.
Yeah.
And it's about doing those things that a creative person can do. And I know that's what the maker movement is really about.
Yeah.
But it kind of forgot. And people became so impressed with what they'd achieved they kind of forgot what they were setting out to do.
Yeah.
It's like going on this journey to the, you know, to the other world, and then kind of like finding this island halfway and being happy in this maker island. It's like, no, it's boring. No one cares.
Well, you're able to make a good point by separating making from creating in that sense.
Let's be creative, because if we can allow 1% of people to become makers, which is probably not really, it's 0.1%.
Yeah.
We're going to be able to enable 100 times more people to be creators, if not 1,000 times more.
I kind of got that from your mission as well, with what you're setting out to do here, is enabling, empowering people to be
creative. And democratizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to democratize where I can, in my own small way, democratize design and democratize manufacturing.
Yeah.
So if, for example, you use your maker skills to program an Arduino to do something in the home, right? You've used your software skills, which is kind of privileged, really, in a way, although we're trying to allow more people to have those skills, to make that thing. So that's not wholly democratized, as far as I'm concerned, because it uses that particular platform, and it's not accessible to everyone. And then the second thing is, if you've made your thing with your Arduino, how do you put that into production?
Yeah.
Like, you can't. You can make one, maybe 10 of those things. And they've used a chipset that's not the chipset that would be used in high volume.
Yeah.
So the platform I'm trying to create already uses a chipset that's low cost. Yeah. So when I started out, the microcontroller we were using was a Microchip PIC.
Yeah.
Then we moved to an AT Tiny, which is what the Arduino is made out of. And when I was doing this, there was no Arduino, because I started this like over 12 years ago.
Okay.
So none of this maker thing existed at all. And I was hiding away in my garage in my little space, creating all of this. So I wasn't aware of all of this, and I've only just like surfaced and realized that people are doing these things. So I wasn't happy with using like an AT Tiny, and then we looked at the Texas Instruments MSP430. These are all microcontrollers that people use to sort of make things. But what bothered me is that, okay, yeah, we can make a cute demo creative thing with it, but when that goes into production, so say for example it was a toy company, say for example Mattel, a toy designer would create, using that chipset, a demo of the toy. Mattel would then send it to their team in Hong Kong, who would then reverse engineer that using local chips, using the Taiwanese microcontrollers. And that bothered me. So I ended up meeting the person who represents the Taiwanese chip company.
Okay.
And so we made our platform out of those low-cost chips. So now, if anyone creates anything with our platform, it's instantly you can make a million of them.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a long explanation.
Yeah, but it's
connecting the two, because it's not just democratizing design, you have to democratize manufacturing.
Yeah, as well.
So
yeah.
Now it's not a cute one-off thing. You've used a toolkit, really easy to use. Use a toolkit as easy as social media, and now you can send that off and have a million of them made.
Yeah.
That's like really democratized.
Well, that's the way I'm a tech guy myself. That's the way I feel that platforms do. So I think of it in terms of a platform.
Yeah.
Super easy onboarding, super accessible.
Yeah.
And perhaps I can create the value that you can benefit from in a sense.
Yeah.
And
that's happened a lot because things are app-based.
Yeah.
So you can use your skill set to create some sort of immersive app or something like that. But hardware is so much more difficult.
Yeah.
And it's more difficult because generally of tooling costs. So most pieces of hardware we have are made from injection molding plastic or forming metal.
Yeah.
And those tools cost hundreds of thousands, if not millions. So the iPhone, for example, these numbers up, but just suppose it's designed by 10,000 people, very similar people in San Francisco.
Probably someone somewhere along those lines.
Sat in San Francisco, right, pretty much. And then it's manufactured by 1 million people in one factory in China. And it has to be, because the tooling to create that device, to make it affordable, even though it's $1,000, is only affordable when you make hundreds of millions of those things. So as well as democratizing the design, I'm trying to democratize for the things that we create, the manufacturing process, yeah. because the tooling costs for print are tens or hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
So the book that we've designed, the tooling cost for that is a few hundred dollars.
Yeah.
And we can make 100 books or 10 books.
Yeah.
And it's affordable.
If we look at this shift that we're in, some people call it, I don't know, digitalization or something like that. The process that you described for me is the iPhone process is an industrialized process of thinking, not easily accessible for a lot of people, but the thing that your process represent is super easy access at any level.
Yeah, at any level, by any person, with any skill set, at any volume.
Like, do you think that is a quality of the next phase of the human saga? Is that how we will think about the way we think? Tonight when you showed your stuff and the questions fell in, they all thought of the features, not the effect that you want to talk about. And it's instilled in our brain. We think this way. So do you think that we will shift to that the norm will be a democratized manufacturing as well? Or do you hope that's
I
the
hope
part?
So, and I think so, because otherwise humans are surplus to requirement in our own lives.
Yeah, pretty much, yes.
So... And I think that's happened in the past, you know, like as we acquire skills and new ways of doing things, then it's the privileged few that can have access to that. But then as it becomes democratized and more people have access to it, then...
The process has worked in a sense, but it has enabled the privileged first.
Yeah.
And we can certainly argue a few hours if the drip down economic effect really works or not.
I have another version of that.
Yeah.
It's called bubble up economics.
Yeah.
And what it is we give all the money to the poor people, or give all the money to people who don't have money.
Yeah.
Just give them all the money. And then what we do is we design products and services to lure them into giving us their money, and we take all their money from them.
Yeah.
Because if that is a ludicrous concept, then so is trickle down. It's only as ludicrous as trickle down.
Yeah.
So bubble up economics. I reckon that's what we do. Just give all the money to poor people.
Well, it's a nice concept. The trickle down economy is it's a good.
It's ridiculous.
It's a good argument for someone that wants that to work.
Yeah, but if that argument works, then so does bubble up.
Yeah.
So just give all the money to poor people.
Cool. One more thing I thought about. The reason you fell into... I know that it's not at one certain point, but somewhere along the lines you must have had a sense or a feeling that it's ink. It needs to be the ink stuff that... some tipping point where you saw that it needs to be along these lines for it to work. That's probably not a very good question.
No, it's fine. It's 'cause for me that's not really what it's about. It's about this sort of desire to connect everything. And I don't mean like connected devices. I just mean, to me, everything is relevant.
Yeah.
Everything is part of the story. Everything is part of us. And that's more like how I feel, like, because everything is everything, and everything in the universe is connected, because otherwise it's not in the universe, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's not connected, it's not in the universe.
Yeah.
And so most of what I do, I've just stumbled across, or, you know, it's come from other people, or... You know, and I was doing my PhD with electrons and whatever. And then it's a professor that started a business because he discovered printing transistors.
Yeah.
And I joined that business.
Yeah, okay.
And then I worked there for 4 years.
Okay.
And that inspired me with print as a process. Mm. But it was nothing to do with what I do now, because I was building for them inkjet printers to 3D print transistors.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, I said like... 16, 17 years ago.
Mm.
And then when I started my own thing, I just became inspired with print because I happened to go around the print factories. So I got inspired by print because of where I worked, but the print that I discovered is totally different.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with just regular print processes. And I love going to factories and I love seeing how things are made. And I've been very, very lucky in my life to visit many, many places to see how things are made.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with seeing how things are made.
What on stage, mm-hmm. I had a sense that you have a really strong why. You explained it a few times, certainly when you talk about your mission now. Mm-hmm. Was the why in place earlier, or has it grown into this why? If you understand?
Yeah. I don't think I fully know the why yet.
Okay.
And I only the wise ask the wise. Mm. So we have to ask the wise. When I was at university, some lecturer told me about in Japan or somewhere that they go five wise deep, and only children really go five wise deep. So, you know, why is the sun yellow? You tell them, and then it's like, but why? And then you tell them, and they're like, but why? But why? And it's not just why. You have to go why, at least five whys
deep. To get to the core.
Yeah. And the challenge is never the challenge that you think. So for me, none of this is a technical challenge. And what I've said is I've said since the beginning, the biggest piece of innovation that I know I need to discover and hope one day to come up with is a business model. That's the real challenge.
Yeah. I'll certainly do my part. I was thinking that when I heard you earlier today, that we're going to order some stuff and play around with.
Yeah,
of course. Because in my own little vision, this is totally along the lines where I want technology to go.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to end up with printed stuff. It's that I want it out of the way, but enable the effects of it.
And how
we do that, I don't know yet.
Through play. We just need to make things accessible so we can play with them.
Yeah.
And then be inspired. And the thing is, if we democratize design and manufacture, then I love the idea that, say, someone in South Africa, for their local inspiration, design something for their market rather than this, you know, 10,000 people in San Francisco, 1 million in China.
Yeah, because I totally subscribe to that idea. Yeah. We call it empowerment or something like that.
Yeah. And it's not just a good thing for people. It's not just kind. So if that person in South Africa creates that thing that they're inspired by their local environment, suddenly becomes hugely relevant for someone in Iceland who would never have thought to create it. The more diverse we make things, the more innovative we become and the safer we become. Because if we all do things in the same way, if that way goes wrong, we're literally doomed.
Yeah.
And diversity of in every aspect of thought, of creativity, of skill sets, diversity is the only thing that stands between any species and extinction.
Yeah. Totally. So, in every complex system, diversity is the fail-proof in a sense, I guess. So
And imagine totally if we saw that as the way to save everything in ourselves.
Yeah, that's a really, really nice thought.
Yeah, if that becomes like not a kind thing to do, but if that becomes like you have to be like this to save ourselves, then we will be a lot nicer to everyone.
That's the type of shift I personally want, that it's not driven by some social contract or something.
No, like being politically correct or whatever. Yeah. It's like we need to be that way because it's in all of our interests and we need to see that.
And it can certainly be egoistic to be that the way, because we know that it will benefit us and the length of my family or something like that.
Yeah, we need to be kind to everyone for our own selfish reasons.
Yeah. Do you think that you will achieve that with your stuff?
So It's never about like reaching the top of the mountain and conquering something and achieving everything. It's always about achieving incremental change towards your goal.
Yeah.
And then we see every single step of our journey as success.
Yeah.
And whether we reach the goal or the end or not is irrelevant. Mm. And then we appreciate our journeys. And then our lives don't become about reaching a destination. Our life should become about every single day and every single step that we move forward. Because ultimately in life, the destination is death. Mm. So don't become too obsessed with destination.
No, agree on that. One final question. I could talk all night, I guess. Pick your brain. But one final question. What do you think that life 30 years from now will be?
It's really difficult to know. I think if we went there, it would surprise us how similar it is to now, because I think that's what would happen if we went from 30 years back to now.
Mm.
And I think 30 years back to now will be equivalent to at least 90 years.
Mm.
And I think that the differences will be in the subtleties. And so that's why the differences wouldn't be hugely visible.
Mm.
Everything would be subtly different, but in terms of like an increased resolution of technology, rather than big lumps of technology and machines and robots visibly everywhere.
Mm.
At first you won't realize, but then the more you immersed in it, you'd realize how much the technology is in and within everything, which is why it will seem invisible.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And it fits my bias as well as a tech guy, I guess, because that's pretty much how I want it as well.
Yeah.
I think perhaps we would be like a bit surprised of some norm shifts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And hopefully we will be better at understanding the systems in the human capacity, so we can kind of understand how not to design stuff.
Well, I hope, you know, that also we evolve spiritually.
Yeah,
a lot.
I totally
as well.
Think we will.
I mean, I hope so. I mean, I really, really hope so. I think that's the biggest risk. The biggest risk. One of the biggest risks to me is that we don't evolve spiritually, and we allow the fear of the darkness to cause us to hurt each other. Because the fear of the unknown and the fear of the darkness has driven a lot of things. And I think the biggest thing we need to lose or remove from society is our ego.
Yeah.
And I would hope that in 30 years we realize that we don't actually exist.
Well, you have quite a lot of arguments that we don't supporting that. Or that we are all the same and stuff like that on the real high described level at this point. But it hasn't, I guess, poured out into society.
No, because it's a scary thought.
Yeah.
I mean, to realize you don't exist, it's a difficult question to ask yourself, because the moment you realize you don't exist, then you realize you never even asked yourself the question.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like it's locked in a paradox. To be able to see that is locked in a paradox. Mm. And then when we question, you know, whether we have any free will or any things like that, the answers to those things are locked in paradoxes that prevent us from going there, because I believe that our brain's job is to create a mind that is a reality machine.
Mm.
That's what it does. So our brain creates a sense of reality from input, processing power, and memory.
Yeah.
So if you remove all of the input from your mind, your brain will go into a free running mode and just create a reality out of anything it can grab.
There's quite a lot of support for that thought line as well.
Mm.
I listen to Sam Harris podcasts a lot, and he has Yes, dribbled with that thought. I can't drop any names of the ones.
I'm really ignorant, and I don't read. I probably read less than President Trump, to be quite honest, which
well,
is probably not a lot.
Well, I don't think that's possible.
Well, so most of what I feel comes from first-hand experience of being in the wilderness, or, you know, I mean, I was fortunate enough to experience being in and coming out of a coma a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And it was an induced coma after I was gored by a stag in the wilderness. Well, I'm not in the wilderness. I was walking home from the pub. Anyway.
Gored by a stag?
Yeah. It's got on my throat.
Oh.
Yeah, it put its antlers from the front, through the front of my, through my trachea, esophagus, and stopped at my spinal cord.
So it's a close call.
It was a close call. Two millimeters left or right, I would have bled to death.
Oh, shit.
Two millimeters deeper, it would have penetrated my spinal cord. Anyway. Anyway, they got a helicopter, patched me up and all that, and put me in a coma for a week. And is a cocktail of propofol, diazepam and morphine.
Mm.
So all my senses were shut down.
Mm.
And I lay in this coma for a week, and it took a week for me to come out of it. But I lived through many alternate realities.
Okay, so this is something that you recorded in your, your head.
Yeah, because they're memories, they're not dreams.
Yeah.
So my brain, having all the senses shut down, recreated alternate realities.
Yeah.
And the noises of building works outside, the noises of the machines, some of the nurses' faces, some of the voices of the people around me trickled in little bits. They ended up becoming part of a new story, a new space and place that I lived.
Yeah.
But that place slowly morphed eventually to land back in reality.
To your
as
own,
the drugs wore off. And so on reflection, that's what I saw. My brain is a reality machine based on what it can grab, what it can remember, and what it can process.
Well, the big thought line of that is, from what I understand, that we have a collective ability to project this reality. And
but how can we not? It's just, like, we ask these questions as if we have, like, how can we not all be connected? Otherwise, we wouldn't be all here together, you know? So we're all immersed in the same soup of senses.
Oh.
So our brains create very, very, very similar realities because we're all receiving the same inputs. So reality is a collective reality, of course.
Yeah.
Like, we ask these questions, and it's like asking, is there life in the universe? You know, looking through the telescope, and it's like, don't be such an idiot. The life in the universe is on the other end of the telescope, and it's you looking through it. It's like, how can you know? It's like, we are proof that there's life in the universe, right?
Yeah.
And how can it exist here and nowhere else? It's a dumb question to wonder whether there's anyone else out there. It's like, of course there either is or has been or will be.
Yeah.
Like, is an inevitability.
Well, most people that study cosmos have I don't know the English word here. They understand that we're not alone.
Yeah, they have no doubt. But what stands in between the way and realizing that is our ego.
Yeah.
And our ego is the problem. Our ego stops us believing things like that. Our ego makes us think that there has to be something outside of all of this, and that it can't all just be chance. Our ego stops us having the sense of collective reality. It stops us having the sense of collective consciousness. It makes us think that we have this choice, and that we are in control of our own journeys and everything. It's our ego. And so I hope that in 30 years in the future, we've managed to get our ego under control and realize we don't exist. And then I think we'll all be a lot happier.
Well, I think we do, because I think this is the end of industry where we're at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing this leap, and hopefully we will end up in the type of experience-oriented thinking that you have.
Definitely, yeah.
Why should I invest my time in your story and your mission?
I don't know.
This is where you sell.
See,
your
I'm
product.
Not very good at selling. I just because I just want people to just be okay.
Everyone won't have the satisfaction of seeing you on stage and understanding by your process that this is something that we need to invest in. So you
see, I create experiences, and experiences have to be experienced to appreciate.
Yeah.
So
whatever wording you're doing now won't fit the experience, I guess.
Yeah, so if anyone's familiar with the Tao Te Ching, which is the sort of Chinese philosophy from 2,500 years ago, the first line of the Tao Te Ching is the Tao that can be told is not the universal Tao. So it's this spiritual book that starts off by saying the words in this book are not what this book is about.
Yeah.
And it's the same. I mean, the experience told is not the true experience. Yeah. If I describe a holiday to you, it's not as good as a holiday.
Yeah.
So I'm never going to be able to... I create experiences.
Yeah.
You have to experience them. And also, it says in the Tao Te Ching that that passers-by will be drawn in by the sound of your music and the smell of the food that you're creating. And they'll come along and enjoy, but they will leave more deeply spiritually enriched than they could ever have imagined. So I hope that the music that we create and the noise and the if I can make a video of the things that I make, I would love to make a video just of people's faces, not of what I create.
Oh.
That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
Videos of people's smiling, happy faces, and that draws people in. I'm never going to sell what I create because people have to experience it.
Yeah. That's a great pitch, actually.
Okay.
So I think you kind of nailed it there.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure talking to you.